This is the In Focus podcast from The Hindu.
Welcome to The Hindu's In Focus podcast. My name is Sriram Srinivasan and I am your host today. We'll now discuss about the new rules that the government has introduced to regulate the digital space. Called the Information Technology Guidelines for Intermediaries and Digital Media Ethics Code Rules of 2021, these rules seek to provide a grievance redressal mechanism for users of social media platforms, messaging applications, streaming services, as also digital news publishers. These are stricter and more broader in scope compared to the existing rules. To discuss the implications of these guidelines, we have with us Pranesh Prakash, co-founder of the Center for Internet and Society and an affiliated fellow at Yale Law School's Information Society Project. Hi Pranesh. The last time a government introduced rules to regulate digital intermediaries was way back in 2011. What the government has come up now with is a broader set of rules that targets not just the intermediaries, but many others. Can you take us through what has happened and also the context behind them?
Sure thing. So for context, I think you kind of need to go back further than 10 years, actually to a situation where Bazi.com, which many people might not be familiar with, which was a precursor to Amazon.com in India as an online marketplace, was actually taken to court. And its CEO was made to appear before court for something that a seller on that platform was selling. Now, the seller was selling a video clip that was non-consensual and should have been removed. But clearly, when it was removed, it isn't the liability, it isn't the mistake of the platform for it having been made available for a little while. And it's, after all, a kind of eBay kind of site where people can meet each other, now that has morphed into Amazon or Quikr or OLX and so on. In order to prevent this kind of a situation where an entity which is not responsible for particular content, is not responsible for particular unlawful act, I should say, is actually made responsible for it, there was a need for a change in the law. And thus, Section 79 was brought in through an amendment into the Information Technology Act 2000, and this amendment was passed in 2008 in December of that year. This section provides a limited kind of protection, a safe harbor, a shield to intermediaries, and it, which is a very vast term, and I can go a little bit into what that means a bit later, but it protects them from being harassed. It protects them from being held liable for content that other people have done or have made, or for unlawful acts, I should say, rather, that other people have done. And it provides also for exceptions to this shield. And one of the exceptions is if the intermediary does not follow due diligence as laid down by the government. And so this document, these rules, which were first made in 2011 and have been, you know, a renewed version of which have been made now in 2021, actually are those rules of due diligence which are to be observed by intermediaries to have a shield from being harassed for what other people do on their platforms. So that's a long-winded explanation, but I hope that makes sense. And in addition to that, in the 2021 version, the government has also added a new part to this. They've made these rules not only under the provision of the IT Act that covers intermediaries, but also the provisions that cover blocking of websites and so on. And under the general power of rulemaking under the IT Act, and they want to regulate other manners of online content, even those which are directly published and not going through or not targeting intermediaries. So online news publications are also targeted by this, even when they don't act as intermediaries. A particular subset called publishers of online curated content are also targeted by these rules. And so it's mostly to do with intermediaries, but not exclusively, is how I would put it. And mostly to do with rules that they need to follow in order not to be held liable for third-party unlawful activities.
So it's not just internet service providers and social media intermediaries like Google and Facebook, but also digital news publishers and streaming services, right?
Absolutely. So the term intermediary is very broadly defined under the Information Technology Act. It covers any entity that essentially sits between the end user and anyone else. So, for example, your internet service provider, which acts in essence like a telephone line, which doesn't see what you are, watching, what you are reading, and so on, if it's encrypted, you know, that is as well as much an intermediary as an entity that provides. For instance, thehindu.com is a web address that needs to be translated into an IP address. The company that provides you with that web address of thehindu.com, with which you registered that address, they are also an intermediary with respect to you, right? They are providing you services and they are sitting in the middle between those who are using that address and the Hindu website. And so they're an intermediary. One example we cited in 2011, which still hasn't been accounted for instance, is there can be decentralized intermediaries as well. For instance, there's a technology called onion routing, and there are networks such as I2P and Tor, which allow for anonymized movement of bits over the internet. So they are anonymizing networks. And those are also intermediaries. When you, as an online newspaper, you allow for comments underneath articles, you also become intermediaries because those are third parties who are posting something which is viewable by me and which is being hosted by you. So it's not just web hosts, people who are hosting content, who are intermediaries, but a much, much, much wider range of actors, most of which the government hasn't really thought about when making these rules. Interestingly, we raised this objection in 2011, and in 2011 we proposed we put out a counter proposal. We proposed a set of guidelines which actually take into account these differences between different types of intermediaries and apply different rules to each of them based on their characteristics, and also which were in compliance with constitutional requirements and protect the constitutional right to freedom of speech, which we believed in 2011 when I was part of the Center for Internet and Society, that the rules did not abide by Article 19(1)(a) and Article 19(2) of the Constitution of India. And even now, I believe that it's quite likely that if this goes to court, then large parts of these rules will be struck down as unconstitutional.
Is there a reason why this intermediary term has been used in such a broad way? Is there a precedent outside India?
I can't offhand think of this kind of an precedent. The term intermediary, of course, is common in laws outside of India as well. But if you look at regulations in the EU, for example, it does distinguish between different classes of intermediaries. If you look at the, for example, the Communications Decency Act in the US, it actually also creates classes of intermediaries and doesn't apply the same, or doesn't actually use the term intermediary to cover all of, you know, all these different categories of actors. So it is a term that is useful, and with regard to protection, you should cover intermediaries. But in terms of saying when certain actors are liable for third-party unlawful activities or may be held liable, you actually need to be a bit more specific. You can't say that the same set of rules will apply to all. For instance, you don't want an ISP to be held liable when it can't even see what it's carrying. In the case of encrypted traffic, which much of the traffic over the internet nowadays is. So why should an ISP even have to go to court and say that we are not liable for what others are transmitting through our networks, right? That's quite ridiculous. Why should entities which have nothing to do with content, which aren't hosting content, etc., be made liable? And even if you are hosting content, the question is, did you exercise any kind of editorial control over it? And so we have a set of guidelines which go far beyond the issue of editorial control right now. If I may cite just one example, under these rules, you have to, if there's a cybersecurity incident, you have to notify the government authorities. And if you don't notify the government authorities, you may be held liable for third-party unlawful activities. Now, it's not really clear to me why the question of liability arises, because there is a separate law on the matter, there's a separate regulation on the matter, which requires you to notify the government. And if you don't comply with it, then the consequences under that law should apply. Again, those are also regulations made under the IT Act, as a matter of fact. But why should you lose your protection from liability for third-party unlawful activities just because you haven't reported a particular incident to the Indian government, a cybersecurity hacking incident, say, to the Indian government within the time frame stipulated in the law? Like, it makes no sense. There is no connection between these two, and yet that is the way the regulations under these guidelines are actually framed.
You mentioned Section 79 of the Information Technology Act, as also the US's Communication Decency Act, where Section 230 is somewhat of an equivalent. This clause is supposed to free social media intermediaries of liabilities arising from not moderating content. How do you see both these laws in the context of the new rules?
The way Section 230 of the CDA in the US acts, and the way Section 79 acts with the addition of these rules actually becomes, you can say they're the opposite of each other. So under Section 230, you are allowed to remove content and you aren't required to remove content. Here, with these rules, with the rules that were made in 2011, you are required to remove content. You are required to abide by content rules that the government has set, which if it had put in an independent law, would not stand scrutiny of the Constitution. So to give you an example, under Indian law, let me give you a silly example, right? So in a state like Goa, gambling is legal. Casinos are legal. And you may have advertisements for these casinos. Under these rules, promotion of gambling is something that intermediaries are required to prohibit and required to put in their terms of use and prohibit their users from doing. So what the government can't prohibit directly, because the central government does not have the power to ban advertising for casinos in states where it is legal, it is doing through the back door by not directly prohibiting, but by requiring intermediaries to prohibit and requiring them to not allow their users to do these kinds of activities. So in a sense, it's in my opinion, a circumvention of trying to circumvent the limits that the Constitution puts on what the government can and can't ban. What would have made sense is for the government to pick up a few sets of issues which are clearly unlawful, and say, for example, child sexual abuse, imagery, and to have targeted regulations on those, or for instance, if it wants to have something more general, then to focus more on procedure, because there is a lot of legitimate complaints from users of how the procedures for that various large social media companies follow is opaque. So you make a complaint, it's not really clear whether that complaint is being addressed or not, what resolution your complaint met with, why it was resolved one way or the other, or if you are on the receiving end, if something you have put out has been blocked or has been removed, then it's not always clear why, under what provision of their rules it has been removed under, and so on. So to bring transparency within this, I think would have been laudable, and that too, not for every company, but specifically certain large social media companies that operate within India. But that's not what these rules do. They go far, far, far beyond that. And so address your question again, it actually seems to me almost like the inverse of the Communications Decency Act in the US. And let us remember, parts of the Communications Decency Act in the US were actually ruled to be unconstitutional by the US Supreme Court. And similarly, parts of the Information Technology Act and the older version, the 2011 version of these rules, were also held to be unconstitutional in India.
That's interesting. If you were to step back a bit and look at the larger challenges which probably would have forced the government to look at these rules as solutions, how do you look at them over the last 10 years or so? Of course, the challenges of fake news, cyber attacks, pornographic content, and so on are important. As also, I mean, if you have looked at interesting solutions you have seen elsewhere.
Sure. With regard to a lot of these things, the first question we have to ask ourselves is, when we object to content online, are we actually objecting to the person who is putting up the content or the platform where that content is available? Because my answer most of the times is that, given that the platform hasn't really edited the content, doesn't really know about the content, and most of these social media platforms don't have a pre-vetting process in place, and rightfully they shouldn't. which is why they've been a boon for freedom of expression worldwide. And I have a, you know, I often talk of a thought experiment whereby if you think of the number of people from India who've been able to express themselves to a wide audience between 1947 to 1997, and compare that number, which is, you know, through all manners of radio and newspapers and so on, to just the number of people who in the first, 10 or 20 years of the 21st century have been able to express themselves to a wide audience. The second number is much larger, right? So the internet has really expanded what, in a sense, is the promise of constitutions worldwide, that of freedom of expression. It has really brought it within the reach of a much larger number of people, and not just people with, say, printing presses. And that has brought with it a number of problems, because we don't actually always like what everybody has to say, even though we want to protect people's right to speak. And so the larger issue is, how do you negotiate these freedoms with rightfully passed laws which impose limited restrictions on these freedoms, such as laws relating to, say, defamation and so on. And that really is at the crux of it. But then it manifests itself now, thanks to the internet, in terms of questions of whether something is a platform or a publisher, who should be held liable for that speech, and so on. And so in my mind, it's clear that most of the time, it's the person who is speaking who should be held liable for what they say, not the entity that did not exercise any control and just hosts, provides a platform for people to speak. So as an example, I don't believe that in a public square that the municipality should be held liable for what people say in a park. Or similarly, I don't think a courier company should be held liable for what people send through their services, even if it be something illegal. The person who's actually doing the sending should be held liable. Now, that fundamental thing has not changed in the last 10 years. What has changed is the number of people who are distributing objectionable speech of various kinds, much of which is already covered by Indian law, and the kinds of prosecutions that we are seeing for this kind of speech, in many cases for unobjectionable speech. And so the circumstances have changed, but the fundamental principles haven't changed. So we now are in a situation where we have far more examples than we did in 2011 of completely unobjectionable speech, perfectly legitimate speech, being prosecuted by various police departments across India, the central government actually getting into the act, forcing content to be blocked by ISPs, by social media companies, etc., even though that content may be perfectly legal and without an iota of transparency. So, for instance, a news magazine's Twitter account was blocked by the government without having to cite any reasons. Now, the government couldn't block a book without citing any reasons, yet they managed to do so under the IT Act. And there was pushback in India, rightfully, for this. So the circumstances have changed. Concerns around fake news, disinformation campaigns, and so on have increased. But I don't think fundamentally there's been any actual change. Should the rules have been revised? Absolutely, yes, because the old rules were really bad and did not safeguard freedom of expression and were unconstitutional. Were the problems with the old rules actually addressed? For the most part, no. There were a few instances of necessary course correction, but for the most part, most of the objections that we raised were not actually addressed.
Do you want to talk about how social media intermediaries are classified and the burdens that have been imposed upon them? The rules talk about, for instance, significant social media intermediaries, which is a new term.
So there are three terms that are now used. There's the term intermediary, which, as I said, covers everything. There's social media intermediary, which covers those platforms which provide for more than one person to communicate amongst themselves. So, for instance, even in, messaging platforms such as Signal or say I run a server for people to communicate using a protocol called XMPP. Even I am covered by the term social media intermediary, and all of these rules apply to me. All those companies which have internal communication servers or email servers also become social media intermediaries. So even though the term social media is used, the way it is phrased, all these platforms that enable communication, including email, are actually covered. Then, and to be clear, that's not just in India. Social media intermediaries could be entities anywhere in the world, even those that don't operate in India. And these rules apply to them as well. And then there are significant social media intermediaries. These are platforms which operate in India, meaning they have some kind of office in India, which is reasonable, or those which have systemic business activity in India. And then, strangely enough, the rules go on to define what systemic activity means, even though they talk about systemic business activity in the previous sentence. So, as you can see, the rules aren't really well drafted. But those kinds of complaints aside, these are platforms which essentially are targeted at Indians. It's not clear who all get covered by that, and which have more than 5 million users in India. And I believe it's a good thing to distinguish between significant social media intermediaries and others, but I'm not really sure these rules do a good job of it. They expose a new tension where a company that has customers across the globe has to have offices and employees in each of those countries if other countries also implement laws such as this. So to give you some examples, right? Think about something like WeChat, which was banned in India some time ago. Now, WeChat does not target India. It does not have an office in India. But a large Tibetan community in India uses WeChat to communicate with people outside of India. What about up-and-coming platforms such as Clubhouse, which doesn't target people in India? They still, if they cross this threshold, might need to have an office in India if they have systematic activity in India. And it's not really clear to me that what precisely that would cover and would not cover. And so the idea of the internet as, a space where a few people sitting in an office can enable services, across the globe, will change with this. And if every country puts in place these kinds of requirements of needing physical presence in a country in order to do business there, if you go beyond a certain threshold, then it will become very, very difficult for social media companies and for any internet company indeed to be able to survive, because that would make, you know, that will only entrench the monopolies that we have, because it will make it so much harder for other smaller entities to be able to provide services to a large number of people. So these significant social media intermediaries, they need to comply with additional set of regulations and requirements beyond what other social media intermediaries need to. That includes having a complaint tracking system, includes having an office in India, includes having to provide notification of removal of content with reasons. This is something I actually support, including an opportunity to the entity to actually, whose content is being affected, to actually dispute it. And so there are some welcome provisions as well, which I think are actually good. But those, I'm not really sure, need to be put in these guidelines, which deal with the issue of liability, because this shouldn't be a matter of liability. They are required to, all social media intermediaries are required to report cybersecurity incidents to the Indian government. So even those entities which are not, which have less than 5 million users, who might not be based in India, will need to report cybersecurity incidents, even if they have nothing to do with India. And so those kinds of problems still exist, and this division isn't properly applied throughout the rules. So much of the rules are applicable to all intermediaries and all social media intermediaries in some cases, even when they should be applicable to those which essentially target Indians. And ones which Indians are largely using, and those which have Indian offices and so on. Then on to one other topic about needing to provide information about originators of messages. Now, this is a concern that has often arisen with regard to encrypted communications. But it's going to actually take me a while to explain this in depth. If we have time, I'm happy to. Should I get into it?
Yes, there is an end-to-end encryption in platforms such as WhatsApp and Signal. And even they say they don't have access to messages that users share. The criticism is that IT rules requiring the platforms to identify the originator weakens encryption. And there is also a point that says that this has to be read along India's decryption rules. How do you see this?
So we don't have decryption rules in India as yet. There was a draft, limitation, a draft set of rules for limitations being put on encryption in 2017 or 16, if I recall correctly, which did not actually. Which kind of died out, and then we have provisions in the IT Act under Section 69 and 69B, which actually provide for various kinds of surveillance, both of data and metadata, but not targeting decryption. Or they do target decryption, but they use very archaic language of subscribers and so on. It's not really, and those haven't really been applied to the likes of WhatsApp and Signal and messaging apps, as far as I'm aware. So what is this question? What is this originator that they're talking about? Well, when the problem they want to focus on, the problem they want to address is a real one. So that is when there are messages that contain either misinformation or which contain incitement to violence, and that actually lead to offline consequences, what do you do about it? So we've had instances in India where people of different religions are targeted because it is alleged that they are that they're coming to your locality to kidnap children. People of different gender identities have been targeted. People speaking different languages have been targeted in this manner. So it is something that's happened, and this has resulted in several dozen deaths of people who've been lynched to death. And so it is very much a real concern. We've had concerns with these kinds of platforms being used to share videos of people being raped, and that's of concern. We've had issues where violence is propagated through these platforms. But what we often see, though, is that in cases of the perpetration of violence, the incitement of violence, whether through misinformation or otherwise, very often the government doesn't actually go after those who are actually committing the violence, and instead asks about those who are spreading the message on online. And so for me, that raises questions about the motivations of the government and whether they are legitimate or whether they're actually targeted at end-to-end encryption. And further, there's the point that it's easy to track how messages spread if you are the police. If you confiscate someone's phone, you can see who actually forwarded that message. So you actually have a phone number in very many cases of someone who forwarded a message. So say someone has committed some violent act, has engaged in offline violence, you seize their phone to see if someone has actually incited them to do so. And you can read the messages on their phone. You can see who those messages are from. That actually, I don't know of real instances where the government has needed to know originators of a message and is not in a position to actually dig it up through plain police work. And so it's unclear to me why this keeps coming up as though it is some kind of intractable problem that the government doesn't have a solution for. The good thing is, in this case, there are limitations put, unlike in the earlier part of the regulations, there are limitations put for when the government can actually ask for this kind of information. But in my opinion, those limitations still are not detailed enough, and we still need some clarity. But that's on the positive side. On the negative side, what happens to networks which are unable to do this kind of tracking? So while WhatsApp and Signal and messaging platforms such as those might know the immediate hop, so they might know that A sent a particular message to B, but they might not be able to say whether that message which was sent by A to B actually originated from X. They might not be able to say whether it's the same message because it is encrypted, and they have designed their platform to prevent themselves from being able to identify these messages. So in those kinds of situations, are they now under an obligation to change how their networks work? Or when these kinds of requests come from the government, is it okay for them to say that we don't have this information and it's not possible for us to provide this this information. Would that in itself be a violation of the law? It's not very clear. And what about anonymizing networks that I spoke about earlier, like I2P and Tor? Now, those those aren't, as it happens, so significant social media intermediaries, but they might, or actually, very frankly, it's not even clear to me whether they are or not. They aren't, under plain language, they aren't significant social media intermediaries, but under the definition provided in the law, if they have more than 5 million users in India, and if people in India are actually running Tor servers, as there are people in India who do that, then can those people be targeted, even if they don't know who originated, say, a particular email, because the design of the network is such that they can't know? So what happens in those situations, it's actually quite unclear. But just wanted to note that there are good reasons for why this question arises. There are ways which don't need breaking of end-to-end encryption to actually trace people. And yet we have these rules which raise more questions than they answer. And it's not clear to me whether they actually address the problem that that they seek to address.
We will take a break here. And in the second part of the discussion with Pranish, we will talk in greater detail about the rules for digital news publishers and streaming services. See you.
In Focus will be back soon with analysis of the biggest news issues. In the meantime, you can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other platforms. Just search for In Focus by The Hindu. We'll see you soon.